I'm Kevin Hatchard, and this is the Ultimate Sports Podcast. Coming up this week, there's an exclusive interview with the Sports Minister Hugh Robertson as bookmakers and governing bodies join forces to combat the spread of match-fixing and illegal betting. We'll look ahead to the closing stages of the Tour de France and discuss the impact of drugs revelations on both cycling and athletics. There's been another poor tournament performance from an England football team. We'll pick the bones out of a miserable European Championships for Hope Powell's Lionesses. And we'll preview the World Swimming Championships, which begin in Barcelona this weekend. We'll start with British sports battle against match fixing and corruption. The Professional Players Federation, which encompasses football's PFA, cricket's PCA and rugby's RPA, has extended its partnership with Betfair, Ladbrokes and Bet365. The organisations have all joined forces to educate young players about the dangers and potential consequences of match fixing and spot fixing. And they're also sharing vital information in a bid to combat organised criminal gangs. Earlier this week, I went to the House of Commons to speak to Sports Minister Hugh Robertson.
The sports betting industry is growing all the time. That being the case, how important are education programmes like this?
Education programmes are incredibly important, though I wouldn't necessarily say more or less so because of the way the betting industry is developing. Every player in any sport has to know what's right or what's wrong, and whether you're transacting that bet in an old-fashioned way over a counter or you're doing it over the internet, the fact is they still have to know what they are doing, the obligations that are placed upon them as an athlete in that sport, and where the lines in the sand exist. And that is why the partnership that we're talking about today between the three betting firms and the Professional Players Association is so important, because educating young athletes about the dangers here is vital.
And is that the key, that you have to catch athletes young and kind of train them almost as much as they were trained for an event? They have to be trained to negotiate these dangers.
Absolutely. I mean, education for young athletes is an increasing part of their education in a whole number of spheres. So a young Olympic athlete not only needs to learn about this, they need to learn about doping, they need to learn about how to handle the media, they need to learn to how to handle the attention, all the other things that go with being a top athlete. In this country, we're getting much better at providing that sort of help and guidance at an early age. It is really, really important in this world of illegal betting that actually they get those right lessons early, and that's why this partnership is such a good idea.
Are you encouraged that the betting companies haven't just shrugged their shoulders and said, well, it's not our problem, they've actively got involved?
I'm very encouraged by that, and I thank them very much for doing it, and particularly thank the three firms involved in this today. It's one of these things that is in nobody's interest. If people are caught betting illegally, it's very bad for this country's sporting reputation, it's very bad for the sports and the athletes, and actually it's useless for the betting firms, because you don't want your betting exchanges manipulated illegally. So it is in everybody's interest to crack down on this, and this is a really good partnership.
We've had so many good British sporting successes recently, and obviously as part of your role you'd want that to lead to more grassroots participation. I guess an important part of that is people have to believe what they see on the field.
That's absolutely right. In terms of grassroots participation, we're particularly proud of the fact that we're the first host city. You've got more people playing sport as a result of the Games in the history of the Olympics. 1.4 million extra people are playing sport in this country that were not doing so when we started on the Olympic journey. For those that want to watch sport, it is absolutely crucial that what they see in front of them is a fair reflection without any form of illegality. As soon as you lose the integrity of sport, almost everything is lost.
Just finally, there's an attitude that I come across sometimes that people tend to think, well, this is a problem for Asia, or this is a problem around the world. This isn't something that would happen here. We haven't had many examples, but obviously it's something we have to be constantly on our guard against.
Absolutely, we have to be constantly on our guard against. We live in a global world. We live in a very well-connected world. And what starts in the Far East on the Indian subcontinent very quickly washes up against our shores. If you don't believe that, if you think that's a simple scare story, look at the way that money tends to manipulate senior tennis competitions, junior football leagues, or crucially, test matches at Lord's. And we just had an example of where that has gone wrong. So it is really, really important that we take all the right measures here and then encourage people internationally to take similar measures in their own domains.
Well, we can't say much about the Open Golf, apart from the opening round at Muir Field was a disaster for top British players like Rory McIlroy, who shot 79, Luke Donald, who carded 80, and Justin Rose, who managed a 4-over par 75. And the second Ashes test is ongoing, but it's worth a mention because this week's guest, Jake Robson, was at Lord's on Thursday.
It was an interesting opening day. Probably not the end result that England would have been hoping for, especially after winning the toss and choosing to bat, to end that many wickets down for that few runs really is far from what they would have wanted. And quite frankly, disappointing as well if you consider the fact that Steve Smith picked up 3 wickets. You know, he was their sixth bowler, a part-time leg spinner, not really the kind of person you want to be getting out to.
No, so an intriguing start to that test match, and we'll see how it plays out over the next few days. But now let's switch our attention to the Tour de France, and barring an absolute disaster, Chris Froome is set to give Britain a second win in Le Tour in as many years after Sir Bradley Wiggins won the race last year. Froome's built up a lead of more than 5 minutes over the first 18 stages, so we expect him to secure glory on Sunday. Another Brit who'll be looking for glory on the final day is Mark Cavendish. He's chasing a record 5th consecutive final stage win on the Champs-Élysées, an achievement which would outshine his hero Eddie Merckx, who won the last stage of the Tour 4 times between 1969 and 1974. Well, back to Froome, and his incredible displays this year have led to depressingly inevitable questions about doping. The Team Sky rider insists that he's clean.
I mean, I can understand why people are asking, given the history of the sport and that they've been let down so many times before. I'm also one of those people who've been let down. I've also believed in people who have turned out to be cheats and liars, but I can assure you I'm not.
Let's tie this up with the controversies that have been in athletics in the last week or so. Tyson Gay and Asafa Powell, two of the most recognisable sprint stars in athletics, both testing positive for banned substances. It's very, very difficult when you have high-profile people who fall foul of the drug regulations. It's difficult to then maintain the integrity of that sport, whether it be cycling with Lance Armstrong or athletics with these top guys.
Well, yeah, I mean, cycling, especially with Lance Armstrong, because in sprint racing, there over, you know, in history, certainly in the last 20, 30 years, there have been people who have been convicted or have been caught for being drug cheats. In cycling, it's a fairly recent thing. I mean, the Lance Armstrong thing, although it happened over a period of years, dating back to quite a few years ago, it's only really been unearthed in
the
last couple of years.
We've only realised the extent of it, haven't
yeah,
we? Yeah,
exactly. So that's the main difference, I think. Everyone's kind of, with 100-metre sprint racing and athletes, it's not, I wouldn't say it's old news, but it's certainly something that we've got used to. And, you know, when Olympic champions have been found to be drug cheats, it's something that we've grown accustomed to, whereas in cycling, and this is why I think there's all these questions raised. I mean, I'm sure just because the fact that the Lance Armstrong thing has really blown up in the last year and we've really found out everything, I think whoever was leading the Tour de France at this stage would have faced similar questions.
Well, Team Sky said from day one that they were going to run races clean. They were going to make sure their riders didn't take anything, didn't use any tactics that were outside the rules. They've actually let coaches and riders go who've been involved in drugs in the past. So if they were found not to be clean, that would be an utter disaster for the sport, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, especially as we're looking at potentially a second Tour de France winner in as many years from that team. I mean, where do you go?
Where do you go from there? There is nowhere to go, is there?
No,
there's
absolutely nowhere. I mean, the thing with sprint racing is, or sprint running, I should say, is that it's, although obviously everybody runs for their country, it's a much more of an individual sport. So you'd hope that it's something that you can kind of weed out. But I mean, when you've got whole teams potentially colluding in cheating and doping, it could be very difficult to stop.
Let's switch our attention to football then. It's been a thoroughly depressing year for English representative football. The under-21s didn't manage a single point at the Euros. The under-20s failed at their tournament. And unfortunately, England's women have crashed out of the European Championships, having taken just 1 point from their three group games. They were beaten 3-0 by France in their final group match, a game that demonstrated a massive golfing class between the two sides. Lots of pressure now on the England coach, Hope Powell. She wants to carry on.
I think it was a gallant effort. You know, we dug deep. At the end of the day, I think France were just too good for us. You know, they went 1-0 up early doors. We decided at half-time, 5-10 minutes into it, we're going to change it, we're going to go for it. So, quick on the break, we got punished, and so it was difficult to get back into it.
Jake, nobody can take away from what Hope Powell has done for women's football in England and the progress the team has made under her. And we shouldn't forget that she is responsible not just for the senior team, but for other teams as well in different age groups. So it's not as simple as the senior team has failed and therefore she has to go. However, there were some worrying things came out of this tournament. England seemed to go backwards, not just in terms of their individual play, but in terms of the tactics, which were England were just hoofing it when they were under pressure, which was a depressingly familiar thing to see. And there will be questions, because if the senior team are playing so far below their potential, that's a worry, isn't it?
It's a worry in any sport, anywhere, really, isn't it? Because then where do you sort of go next with, as far as the people or the players coming through? You know, they have, if they're looking up and seeing that, I mean, we've seen it's become very evident with the men's game. You know, for many years now, that the men's senior team haven't really performed in the Euros and in the World Cups, and it's, you know, it's filtered down, as you said, with the under 21s and the under 20s. Perhaps the women have been looking to the men for some inspiration, and
that's not
found
the right
none.
Place.
No,
look,
exactly.
Well, I spoke yesterday to somebody who watches the women's team a lot, and she said to me that the thing that's really worrying about it is that they don't normally play like that. And there is a real problem with England representative teams at international level, whereby it doesn't matter how talented they are on the ball, it doesn't matter how good their technique is, when they're under pressure in tournament games, that goes out the window. And suddenly we go back to the old 60-yard ball towards the striker, totally isolated. Whereas you look at a team like France, they picked England apart, playing just quite simple football, keeping the ball on the floor, playing it into feet, good movement, nothing groundbreaking, nothing that's going to, you know, melt anybody's brains, but just very simple football, and that is a bit of a worry.
Well, that's the thing, and what you just said there, you could apply to any England team in a tournament, not just men, not just women, just both. I mean, we saw it in the under-20s and the under-21s, and we see it time and time again with the national team. You know, it begs the question, just sort of going back to what happened earlier on in the summer, why some of those younger players playing in the senior team didn't go to the under-21 World Cup. And, you know, I don't know what's happened in the women's game further down, but it is evident that it's sort of a tournament problem, isn't it?
And that conservatism has kind of spread through to the management in a way as well. There was a lot of talk before the tournament about really good, promising young players like Jordan Nobbs and Tony Duggan. Now, Duggan did get her chance latterly, scored a goal late on against Russia in the second group game and got a start against France. But a lot of those promising young players we were told about weren't given their opportunity. And instead, you had poor old Kelly Smith, who's just not fit, dragged on for the last half hour, and it was all rather embarrassing. And so that's something perhaps they've got to look at as well. Well, now let's look ahead to the World Swimming Championships, which begin in Barcelona this weekend. High diving, water polo and synchronised swimming will all take place over the next few days, but we'll focus on the swimming. The greatest Olympic swimmer of all time, Michael Phelps, won't be competing. His great American rival, Ryan Lochte, will look to make the most of his absence. There are still plenty of star performers from London 2012 to catch the eye, though. In terms of the British challenge, look out for Olympic silver medalist Michael Jameson in the short range breaststroke events. And after winning a hat-trick of British titles, Welsh competitor Jazz Carlin's a threat in the freestyle distance events. Local hopes rest on Mireia Belmonte. She'll look to make an impact after winning silver medals at London 2012 in the 800-metre freestyle and the 200-metre butterfly. Australia needs to bounce back after their worst Olympics showing for 20 years. Look out for sprint star James Magnussen defending his title in the 100-metre freestyle. South African star Chatel Klos will look to follow up his Olympic win in the 200-metre butterfly. There are some tremendous young female swimmers on show, including Missy Franklin, Ruta Malatita, Katie Ledecky and Yeshi Wen. And there is always a youngster who turns up who wasn't expected to do well, who shaves tons off their best times. That's just the way swimming works. France have a star-studded team there, ones to watch out for, including Yannick Angel, Florent Manadou and Camille Muffat. Well, that's it for this week from Jake Robson and myself, Kevin Hatchard. It's goodbye for now.